Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 22, delivered on April 12, 2012. The title of this lecture is Degrees of Leverage.
Today, Degrees of Leverage. This is in Chapter 13, Capital Structure Basics. And to some extent, this doesn't look like capital structure, the balance between debt and equity. But it really is, at the end of the day, part of the entire globe of how we have to think in order to find an optimal capital structure. In other words, a capital structure where the weighted average cost of capital is at its minimum. Now, remember that the marginal cost of capital is rising step by step. You saw that in that exercise. And eventually, it will overrun the cost, the marginal cost of capital will overrun anything that you could invest in as far as return on investment goes. Now, one thing that I wanted to bring up in that regard, I'm going to turn on this projector. I'm going to show you something, just a freehand sketch of an iOS MCC graph. Show you something here. Now, here is your capital expenditures on this axis. How much money is being spent? Total. Oh, let me put capital. And on this one is your interest rate. Okay, now, suppose that you had an iOS. Here's your iOS. Now, you had one that was cruising in. Let's say this is Project A. This was your best one. It had some return on investment. Now, then you got a step down to a Project B that needs some more money. And then you got a Project C that you can pick up if you get Project B done. You can go on to Project C, which doesn't have as good a return, but it's there. It's a cheap project. And then you've got this project that's D, even lower rate of return, and it's got its own, how much you would spend on it if you had already spent money and taken care of the projects that had higher returns. That's an iOS. Okay. Now let me overlay an MCC, a marginal cost of capital graph on this. Your first rung of capital, combining equity and debt to get your balance, how much it's going to cost you. Your first one is right here. Okay? This is your first break point right here. And then your cost of capital goes up to there. And you hit your break point two. And suppose that there was a third break point. Let's say this one down there. And ever after that, you're above, that's your MCC. So that one is MCC 1, which is your weighted average cost of capital, MCC 2, and MCC 3. I want you to talk to me here. Actually, your breakpoint two is a little farther out there. I put that in a little too close. Breakpoint two is right there. It's where the marginal cost of capital jumped on you. Okay, now talk to me. So you got your breakpoint one, and you got your breakpoint two. Okay, now talk to me. What projects do you accept? Tell me. Which project? Do you take project A? You complete project A with, and its returns is all above the marginal cost of capital. How much you would it would cost you in terms of capital to fund project A. Now, if you look at project B, your marginal cost of capital has jumped. You see that? But project B, the return on project B is well above even the somewhat more expensive second tier of capital, cost of capital. Make sure you see that. Project B has a return on investment that is well above this cost of capital here. Okay, so we're good. But something interesting happens. The marginal cost of capital jumps before you finish project B. Just a little before you finish project B, the marginal cost of capital jumps again. The last few bucks that you're going to use for project B would cost you more than project B returns. It's not much of the project that, as a matter of fact, it looks like it's very little of that project would be funded at a cost of capital above the return on the project. So should I take project B or should I say no to project B? It's just a few bucks. What do you say? In fact, you would say no to it. Even if it were the last dollar, that cost more than the return. I could have spent $30 million. If the last dollar has a cost that is above the return on that project, I'll say no to the whole project. Now, I can promise you that if that sounds wrong, you are not alone, even among business professionals. I have seen people very well intelligent say, what are you talking about? You're saying we have spent, we're talking about, in one case, it was like something like $8 million. We're going to have the last $10,000 of that cost more than the return on the project. And you're saying no to the whole damn project because the last 10 grand is above going to cost us more than the return? The answer is yes. The answer is not even, well, we can talk about it. The answer is we're going to reject that project because there was a little bit of the money at the end was going to cost us more than the return on that project. The best way I can explain it is like this. Even though it sounds like it's just ludicrous, you have to abide the marginal rule. What did the last dollar cost? I'll explain it like this. Madam, you're in the desert. You're thirsty. And you're praying for help. And I come out of the mirage. You are praying to Jesus. And you hear the singing from the angels. My child. Can you sing Hosanna? Hosanna. This is religion. For God's sake, it's serious. I have fluid. Now, all of this is for you. It is pure. It is drawn from the springs of heaven. Except for that last little part down there at the end. I had to borrow some from Satan. He said it was deadly poison. Yeah. But it's just that little bit down there, yeah. So please. Drink and praise me.
No thanks.
What? Got something against guys with long hair? What? Do you see the problem? Just a little tiny bit of it was toxic, but when you mix that with all that pure mountain fresh water that was drawn from Fiji Springs, in which clean children's feet waded, but there's this poison at the bottom. And you're not going to touch it, are you? No. And that's the same idea as behind rejecting Project B, even though a little bit, just a little bit of it at the end, has a cost of capital that is above. It is that higher cost of capital that is the toxic poison to the capital funding of Project B. Because you have just taken money that is worth, that costs more than you're ever going to make on it. And if you're going to do that, you're on the road to ruin in your company. Ah, that's okay. You know, just a little bit of the project costs more. Ah, it's okay. This has just a little bit at the bottom. Sucks really hard, you know. Ah, it's okay. It's just one slice of that pizza has the ghost peppers on it. Okay? Yeah, I don't know if all of you heard it. There's a pizza chain out of New Zealand. I guess they are now penetrating markets in the United States. It's called Hell Pizza. You can ask for pizza. It's sliced into six slices. This pizza is called the Russian roulette pizza. One of the six slices has jalokia pepper on it. Now, if you don't know what that is, that's the equivalent of eating something that will make magma come out your ass. There are YouTubes. Just type ghost pepper and watch YouTube. Some of them actually even, they have people filming the ambulances coming for the victims and all of that kind of stuff. There's one, this macho studly guy. He's doing it. And he just keeps, oh, this is not bad at all. Oh, God. Oh. And at the end, you know, they filmed him going to the bathroom and closing the door and talking to mom. Who I understand was dead, but he was still talking to his mommy. There's a toxic piece here. See this part of the funding right here? You're funding something that has a return that is below what it costs you to do it. You do that, you're wasting money. You don't ever, ever spend expensive money to get cheaper return, ever. I don't care if it's a small amount of the total. It's this whole project that you are funding, and part of that project is going to be funded at a cost above what you can get on it, what you'll ever get on it. And that means that you have just made a fundamental error in your thinking in business. We do what is the, we act on what it is at the end, not on the average, not on the beginning, what happens at the end. And in this case, at the end, I'm spending expensive money for cheap return. Okay? Yeah, go ahead.
What would happen if, say, A, if it goes and it's below MC2, and then you know how you graph B because it has a lower rate of return?
A is below marginal cost of capital, too. So you would say that it's above MCC1. But so in other words, I would say that it's like this.
Right. And then B, had it been first, it would have been above MCC1 and not fit into it.
That's exactly right. That's an interesting point. I think I see your point.
Yeah.
I see your point.
You wouldn't take any of the jobs.
Well, the thing, though, is that if B had had the higher return, yeah, but in business, we gets into almost a philosophical thing. We have to order the projects from the best to the worst. And in this case, A was the best. So if B had been the best, I would have written it first, and it would, if A sucked, then B would have come first, okay? And you know, you're right. I would have taken B, But then I would have probably, I think I would have kicked out A there. It would have just been a matter of which one had the higher return in a case like that. But in this case, A had the higher return, so it comes first in the priority list. If B had had the higher return and A had sucked, then essentially the graph would have been B, like that, and then A would actually have been where B finished up, like that, something along that line. And so I would have just kicked MC2 out.
What if A had a higher rate of return, but it ended up, like, say it's...
A had a higher rate of return than B?
Oh, yeah, A had a higher rate of return than B, and but A was, okay, MC1 is from, like, 0 to a million, and MC2 is above that, and A costs, like, 1.2 million.
Okay, so you're saying, like, MCC...
Yeah.
One is there. MCC2 is a little higher, right?
Right.
Go ahead.
And A is, say MCC is, MCC1 is like 8% and MCC2 is like 11%.
Okay.
And now A has a rate of return of 10% and it's 1.2 million.
So I'd be out here, right?
Right.
So I reject A right off the bat.
Had a rate of return of like 10% or 9%, sorry. And but it was only like 600,000.
It's dead off. It's dead at the beginning because I would. It's dead.
No, but what if B would have actually made money had you
funded it on MCC1 capital?
Right.
I see your point. Yeah.
So what do you do? You regraft it?
No, in a case like that, you find out who talked to you about Project A and you kill that person so that it never existed. No, I'm serious, noob. You've got to do business right. Otherwise, he's going to bitch about Project A. Well, you should have taken that one first. Well, shut up. You know, really? It's not there. If it's not there, it's not there. But once it's in your mind, that goes... It's been presented in your investment opportunity schedule. And that's one of those ugly things in the business world where once it's there, it has to be brought up to the table. A was viable. It was presented. So if we don't want A to be viable and presented, then we have to make it go away and all the people who thought it was a great idea. Okay? Because otherwise, it's on the table. And I can promise you that if you leave those people alive, they're going to be bitching, you turned down Project A. Boo-hoo. You see, they're going to say, there was a project that was better than B. So if B does go south for some reason, just its business judgment, A was, they're going to bitch, why didn't you look at A first? You see what I mean? Because it did have a technically higher rate of return, but it just took more money to fund it. Now, here's what happens, and I was being a little flip there. What I have seen to cope with the slight issue that, and it's, I don't mean that slight, with the issue that you're bringing up, is that they will have different groups proposing on different ranges of cost. You'll have a team that will have cost ranges. You give us two projects that run between $2 and $6 million. Then they'll have a group that will handle bigger capital expenditure projects in the $6 to $20 million range. And what they'll do is they will separate and look at them separately to hoping that there might even be different sources of funding, okay? The unfortunate part is, let me ask this. If you are a lender, a funder of capital, which would you charge over, in a general sense, a higher rate of return, a higher rate, interest rate on? Smaller projects or larger projects? Talk to me. Just think about it logically. Or would there be any difference between the costs that you would, if you're a lender, if you're lending money, or if you're an investor, you're a heavy-duty investor, you've got money that you would lend, you got money to lend. Now, two different types of projects come to you. Projects that have smaller investment need, each of them, and then you've got projects that have larger investment needs. each of them. What do you say on projects? Would there be a difference in what I would charge on those different projects? Will I charge higher interest rates or demand higher rates of return on small projects? Or would I demand higher rates of return on large projects? Yeah.
Would you charge higher interest rates for the smaller projects? Because then with like, when there's more money involved, even with a smaller interest rate, you can still get in the long run.
There is where we get into, and the answer to it is traditionally, you're absolutely right. Here's the logic. It's essentially like volume discounting. I can unload. I've got $50 million to lend. You need $30 million. Yeah, I'm going to charge a lower interest rate because then I can unload on $30 million of what I wanted to invest all at once, so I would give you a discount. And I would charge a higher interest rate for larger amounts of money. Now here is where I don't want to use the word, it's what I call postmodern finance has taken us. That logic actually, which is the logic that is almost always prevailing, smaller borrowers actually in the business world will pay higher interest rates than larger borrowers. However, in the world of microfinance, that would present a massive problem because we would be lending to very, very small borrowers. Some family in Ghana needs $200 to start up, to get capital together for this business that they run. A small community in Vietnam needs $600 for some project that they're working on. In a case like that, if the logic holds, we would have to charge them very high interest rates because we are lending very small amounts of money to them. It's a pain in the ass, just the administrative end of it. Here's where postmodern finance gives us a different answer, though. And I'll give you a little hint of something that's going on in the College of Business about this. Actually, I can justify to heavy-duty investors, not just charitable investors, but I'm talking about to investors who are hard-nosed, return people, I can convince them to charge a lower interest rate to those little tiny micro-enterprises. Why? Because I am talking about, you've got one giant $50 million project. What happens if that thing blows donkey sausage? Okay. You have lost a hellacious amount of money. But what happens if you take that same $50 million and you lend that to 10,000 small, little micro enterprises around the world? You, my good people, have just done some awesome portfolio diversification. You could have one of those, 10 of those, hell, 1,000 of those little enterprises go tap city. You still haven't lost your whole investment. You could have a hurricane blow through Vietnam and destroy half the country. And because I've also been investing on the other side of the planet at the same time in micro enterprises, I got no problem. But if one bad event like a hurricane or an earthquake or a nuclear accident hits that $50 million project, I've lost the whole mother or the whole project. You see the logic? Okay, now let me take you to the story behind this. I promise I'm trying not to be boring here, but this is where we are beginning to think, getting away from, still keeping the models that I teach you, but thinking in more broader ways. Look, it's our principles, principle of diversification. Hell, we can diversify our investment, $50 million on 10,000 investments. That's going to be a lot safer than $50 million on one investment. So I've got a justification for charging a lower interest rate to all those little tiny entrepreneurs around the world than I do to big old Facebook and its face crooks and all that. Here's where this is going. There's a proposal on the table in the College of Business to bring about a new finance course. Maybe something, you don't have to be a finance major, but it might help. And the criticism is from one professor, he said, well, I'm already offering a course like that. The dean has a slightly different idea. He brought up the idea, all right, could we, is there any interest in teaching, his idea was, in teaching a course in Islamic financing. Now, does anyone know what the bizarre, weird thing about Islamic financing, financing under the laws of Islam is? Do any of you know what the totally impossible thing about Islamic financing is? Yeah.
Is it you can't charge an interest rate?
Bingo. Well, how the hell are you supposed to make money if you can't charge interest? Look, I'm from Jewish background. I mean, that seems like that's a sacrilege against God. No interest? But then, of course, I looked in the Old Testament, the same thing was going on. And it was successful. And Islamic financing, oh yeah, that's just going to fail like gangbusters. It's already spreading across the Islamic world. Large countries are completely Islamic financing now. All their banks are. At least to Muslims, to others, they charge interest. But how could it possibly work? How could you have a financial system, financial institution, financial intermediation, where the opportunity cost of foregone consumption is required to be zero? You must give up your money for long-term purposes to others, and you get that money back, but you get no interest on it? How could that possibly work? It violates everything about economics, rational behavior, and finance that I teach you. Well, in fact, it doesn't. In fact, it doesn't. The entire world is experimenting with old and new systems of financing and economics that are completely not being taught here in the United States. So I'm all game for it. If we want to introduce you students generally to a course where you see that the world can work, and it's going to work in very different ways from what you have been taught here, or what your fathers and mothers were taught years ago, it would be great to have that course. I could tell you about microfinancing. I've already told you the logic of microfinancing. It actually works, and it's incredibly successful. And more wealthy investors are jumping on it, not because they feel, you know, gooey about helping poor people around the world so we don't have to see pictures of their kids starving. No, it's smart investment. Other types of financing that are going on, private-public partnership financing. In other words, where essentially you're creating effectively, instead of moving risk from risk takers to risk avoiders, you are actually allocating risk into a sovereign where the risk essentially is borne by the body politic rather than by individual risk takers who have perverse incentives sometimes. Another thing that will be coming in your lifetimes. I talk about money all the time. By the time you're in your 40s or 50s, probably your 40s, the concept of money as you know it won't exist. The stuff that we have in our pockets, it'll be something you tell your kids about that isn't actually there anymore. Have any of you ever heard of Bitcoin? You know what Bitcoin is? It's a completely virtual currency, unregulated. There's no central bank controlling it. And it's an internet currency. Right now, I could name you some heavy-duty international traders, currency traders, speculators, that are even some investment houses that are stocking up on Bitcoins, simply because they figure that they are going to be the currency, or at least an important currency for international transactions in the future, because no government can control the value of them. Essentially, it is a pure free market currency, and we can denominate contracts in them all day long. Those are some of the things that you would see in a course like that, a course in global financing for the future, where we don't have the wrong assumptions of finance still playing out. Because if we keep on with that too long, we're going to eventually, the rest of the world is just going to leave us behind, because already many of these things are just going on like gangbusters. Islamic financing, microfinancing. Some of the big investors in the United States are getting into microfinancing in a big way. Public-private partnership financing.
really, right now, the United States doesn't understand the system, and it's a vicious political war now between public and private financing, instead of seeing it as a partnership where the money-generating capabilities of corporations can be used for projects that benefit not just enterprises specifically, but the whole body of the country in general. Let me get on here. I'm going to talk about just a couple of things here. Suppose that we had 2010 and we had 2011, and I'm going to give you degrees of leverage here. Revenue minus expenses is EBIT, and minus your interest is your EBT, minus tax, and we'll say, oh, let's put 20% to make it easy, brings us down to net. Okay, now, suppose that in 2010, just for the sake of simplicity, we had $250,000 in revenue. 2011, we had revenues grow to $275,000. Expenses were, let's say, $100,000 in 2010. And those expenses increased to $120,000 in 2011, bringing us EBIT up from $150,000 in 2010 to $155,000 in 2011. Is that right? Is that right? Okay. I so suck at arithmetic. Okay. And our interest payments, let's say our interest payments stayed stable at 40,000. No, let's do 50,000. And I don't mean stable. They went from 50,000 up to 52,000 in 2011. So our EBT went from 100,000 to 103,000. Tax at 20% brings us a tax of 20,000 for that year and $20,600, I think, I hope, for the next year. And so our net is 80,000 for 2010, and the net comes up to is that right? 82,400 for 2011. This is kind of old school stuff, and I'm glad they still show this one in the book. It's easy, like I said, it's a pretty easy problem for an exam. If I'm remembering right, DOL. Yeah, like I said, this is chapter 13, just to make sure you know. We have, first of all, something called the degree of operating leverage. It's a percent change in EBIT over the percent change in sales. And then you have this other one called the book uses DFL, the degree of financial leverage, which is the percent change in net income divided by the percent change in EBIT. And then you finally have the degree of combined leverage, which is the percent change in net income over the percent change in sales. Now, I'm going to do these numbers and show you the quickest way that I do them. And then after I've shown you the getting the numbers, it might help trying in explaining them. And instead of trying to explain them right here, it might be better if I did this first. Now, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to show you how I usually do this. I'm going to need three different percent changes. I'm going to need the percent change in sales, the percent change in EBIT, and I'm going to need the percent change in net income. Now, I get all these done right away, and then I apply the formula so that I'm not going back and forth. I get the raw work out of the way, and then that puts me in a better position to just get the ratios done. Now, the percent change in sales, now remember that any percent change is end minus begin over the begin, and then you times it by 100 to get a percentage, okay? Remember that percent change. That's actually one of the more important, simple, stupid formulas that you learn in a class like this, and it applies so many different places. So I'm going to beat that out. As far as your sales go, revenue, and make sure that you can get this number yourselves as well. I'm going to take 275 minus 200, 250, I'm sorry, 275 minus 250 equals divided by 250, and I get, and then I'm going to times it by 100, and I get a 10% change. Sales rose 10%. It's a positive 10%. So my sales went up 10%. Now let me look at my EBIT. EBIT, percent change in EBIT, would be 155 less 150 equals divided by 150 times 100, and I get for that one a 3.33%. So my earnings rose, the percent change in earnings was 3.33%. Now my net income. Percent change in net income would be 82.4 minus 800 divided by 800. My ass. 82400 minus 80000 divided by 80000. Oh, times 100. And I get 3%. Is that right? Okay. My sales increased by 10%. My EBIT increased by only 3.33%. My net income increased by only 3%. So now let's look at our degrees. The DOL would be percent change in EBIT, 3.33%. divided by my percent change in sales, 10%. So I got 3.33 divided by 10. So I get a 0.33. That's not a percent, that's a times. My degree of financial leverage would be the percent change in net income, 3%, divided by 3.33%, and that comes out to be a 0.90 times, and my degree of combined leverage is percent change in net income, which is 3%, divided by the percent change in sales, 10%, which is 0.30 times. Now here's the kicker. The degree of operating leverage times the degree of financial leverage will equal the degree of combined leverage. That's, you can see it, that cancels out. So what I'm saying here is that the magnification of sales to the net income line was actually less than one for this company. It was any volatility, the change in sales, only 0.3% of that change showed up at the net income line, which means this company is relatively safe, all things considered. Now, the degree of operating leverage was 0.33 times. The degree of combined leverage was 0.90 times. So now we can say to ourselves, what was it that caused the volatility from sales to net income? And if I look here, it was my financial leverage that caused it, because it was the larger component of the two that caused volatility. And in this case, interestingly enough, though, because this company actually, the volatility went down from sales to net income. See how the volatility went down? Well, what caused it to go down? My operating leverage. This company is so safe at the net income line, regardless of the volatility of the sales line. This company is so darned safe at the net income line because this company has hardly any operating leverage. It apparently has very few fixed costs. Remember that operating leverage is caused by fixed costs? Apparently, this company is almost pure variable cost. So what is causing all this contraction of volatility? 10% change in sales led to only a 3% change in net income. What caused that compression of volatility? Well, now I can tell you, I can look right here, and you don't have to do that awful stuff. Remember that when we did those coefficients of variation and all those, we were kind of answering the same question. This is the dirty way that it's done. It actually is, I can look at this right now, and I can say, the reason we got all of this safety at the net income line, whether we want it or not, the reason we're so safe at the net income line compared to sales is that we have hardly any fixed costs that could hurt us. We have some pretty decent interest cost. See our interest cost? And it's going up. Well, that's nothing compared to how little risk we have, because we don't have any fixed costs. Well, we have hardly any fixed costs. Almost everything, all of our costs are variable. So that's why we are getting this suppression of sales volatility from 10% to net income volatility, which is only 3%. And that would probably, although there are a lot of other factors involved, that would tell me as a financial person in the company, we'll have probably a pretty low beta. We'll be a company that is attractive to mutual funds for people who are very safety-minded and all that kind of stuff. We won't do spectacularly well for our shareholders in boom times, but at the same time, in recessions, we're going to be a hell of a lot safer than a lot of companies, because when their sales change radically up or down, their net income swings heavily, much more than sales. But our company, for better or worse, and that's our decision whether we want to stay that way, we, when our sales swing up or down, it actually our net income hardly moves. See that? Look at that. 10%, and our net income moved by only 3%. That's going to piss people off when the economy is riding high and our sales are booming. What happened to net income? But they're going to be really happy with us if the kinds of clientele will attract. They'll be happy with us when our sales tank 10%, and that meant only 3% loss at the net income line. That's the idea of degrees of leverage. And that's all I have for you. Thank you. Remember, we